Hello and welcome to the PBT podcast. We are back. I know I wanted to get this podcast started a little earlier this season. I'm Kurt Heelan, the managing editor of Pro Basketball Talk at NBC Sports. But to be honest, due to my lameness and some technical difficulties, we got off to a slow start. But we are going to be here now through the rest of the season with great guests talking about all the latest news around the NBA. And joining us today, none other than PBT's own Dan Feldman. How you doing, Dan?
Good. How are you?
Doing well. I went to the Laker game last night to see the Pacers, and I planned on doing something on Paul George and mentioning the Hickory uniforms and thought it was going to be a nice, quiet night, and it didn't exactly work out that way. Kobe Bryant dropped an absolute bombshell. I don't know if absolute bombshell. This was completely expected, wasn't it, Dan?
That he was going to retire, yes. That he'd announce it now, I thought it was a bombshell. I was pretty surprised. He seemed adamant, as you call it, the Derek Jeter type of farewell tour, that he didn't want that. Now he's stuck with it. He has no choice. I am a little surprised it came now.
I am a little surprised it now, but I think it was a recognition to himself, maybe a hint to Byron Scott, but certainly a recognition to himself and to the fans that, hey, I realize that this isn't going well. And I'm going to let you know now that I'm not going to drag this out over another year.
Well, I'll take it one step further. I think it was a recognition that it's not going well and a recognition that everybody else was starting to really get on him for it not going well. And this is a way to change the narrative. Now we're celebrating Kobe. We're talking about what a great career he had. And, you know, that's all fair. Those are all things we should talk about. All of a sudden, it seems less important to talk about his field goal percentage this season.
Exactly. But, by the way, is at 30.5% after a 4-for-20 shooting against the Pacers. He has been bad. I mean, he's been unequivocally bad this season. I will say that this was the one thing that really surprised me most out of the night. The mood, by the way, in the arena was a bit shocked and a bit sad and a bit kind of nostalgic and melancholy, or basically it was like the new Adele songs. It was kind of what you'd expect. I thought he handled it in a pretty classy way with giving the letter to the fans, even though that is clearly a marketing tool for his upcoming Hero and Villains campaign. But there was a lot, you know, I thought he handled it well. But what really surprised me, and you saw the video, you know, you probably watched the entire or most of the press conference, in the room, just being around him and the other Lakers, is that he's really at peace with the decision in a way that a guy who has spent his entire career trying to fight through every obstacle and not taking no for an answer, it would be. I didn't think he would leave gracefully. And he's kind of reached the point where he's like, I mean, I don't know that he's leaving gracefully, but he did reach a point where he's like, I can't do this anymore. I physically can't will myself to do this anymore.
Well, it's easy to be at peace when you know you've got another game in a couple days and you've got the rest of the season. I don't think it has to sink in for him yet. I'm not sure if it has. It's going to be much harder to be at peace, you know, come next fall when you're used to going back for training camp in the preseason and you're still at home, you're still on vacation. We'll see if he's still feeling as peaceful then.
That's a valid point. And even he says, I don't know how I'm going to feel in a year, but I've always been of the mindset, I don't think he comes back. And a lot of it comes down to he watched the Michael Jordan Wizards years and has said publicly, like, that is just not a place I want to be. That is not a place I want to go. We could argue that he's there right now. He's actually worse than that Michael Jordan on the court right now. But he wasn't going to go to another team. He wasn't going to chase a ring somewhere else. He wasn't going to go play in Italy or China and sell some shoes. When he walked, he was going to walk. And I think that, you know, he's going to go into documentary filmmaking and that'll be his thing. And he'll still be around coaching some young players now and then.
Yeah, when Michael Jordan left the first time, too, though, it seemed like, you know, he was ready. He hit that big shot. It seemed like the right time. He could go out on top, and that competitive nature kicks in. I guarantee this. At some point, Kobe will think about coming back. Whether he actually does, I'd be shocked if he actually does. But practically every player who retires thinks about it. And, you know, you were mentioning how competitive he is. It's not going to be easy for him to say, no, I can't do it anymore.
Especially when that call comes from, and I'm pulling a random team out here, but that call comes from Oklahoma City, who's on the verge of contention, but feels like they could use some veteran depth off the bench for 15 minutes a night. And by the way, you stand a chance of getting a ring with these guys. That's the kind of call that's, you know, would he you know, right now he's saying, no, I would never be anything but a Laker. And he went into detail on that. But when that call comes in a year or two and he's feeling like, hey, all I've got to do is, you know, play 30 games and then at the end of the season, a few minutes and then chase a ring in the playoffs, will he be able to say no to that?
I wonder if he put it out there so publicly that he'll never play for another team besides the Lakers, just so when that moment comes, he won't feel tempted. Like, what would you rather do? Go play 15 minutes for the Thunder and know that everybody knows you're going back on what you said, or go play, you know, get a decent contract for 1 year with the Kings, who are trying to make a splash, and again, have everybody know you're going back on what you said? Maybe that was just his way of saying, like, I need to put pressure on myself not to come back.
I think that you have some points there, but by the way, it would be like the ultimate betrayal to Laker fans if he went to Sacramento for like anything. That would be the one place, one of the places it would just not sit well. There's that history there. I think the other question that I've started to ask about this going forward now is, does this change how the Lakers use Kobe? Does this change how they, you know, try to develop their young players? Does this free him up, or does it free Byron Scott up to kind of, you know, adjust this and actually start developing these guys? I mean, it didn't last night. I mean, against the Pacers, there was Kobe in the fourth quarter jacking up threes, and, you know, D'Angelo Russell was watching from the bench.
Well, I've got to ask a question to answer your question, and you would know better than me. Do the Lakers have a plan right now? Like, what are they trying to accomplish with Kobe and with their team? And, you know, so I don't know if they can change the plan. I don't know if they have a plan that they're not communicating well. I don't know if they are communicating it well and it's as foolish as it looks. I don't know if they're just randomly doing things. I have no idea what they're actually doing.
You know what, though? I think that you've hit the nail on the head for what bothers a lot of people. You know, again, for people who don't know, I'm based in Los Angeles. I go to a lot of Laker games, a lot of Clipper games. But that's the question out here is, Byron Scott, the coach, has always felt like a placeholder. And you know, Mitch Kupchak, the GM, has said, look, we're going to keep Byron here and we're going to draft young players and get a free agent. And once we see what kind of talent we've got, then we'll tailor the scheme to fit them, as opposed to, you know, what you're seeing in New York, which is, like, let's put in the triangle. We can debate the triangle, but let's put in the triangle and get players to fit the triangle and develop that way. Right now, it just feels like Byron Scott's a placeholder until Kobe leaves, and then they start getting serious about everything.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most optimistic view, right? That nobody actually believes in Byron Scott, that they're just going to let him do all these crazy things, and maybe they can stumble into keeping this draft pick, which won't be easy even if they don't win a single game the rest of the year, just how bad Philly is and how the lottery odds work. So I guess that's the best case scenario, that you've empowered a coach who you know doesn't know what he's doing and are just letting him do that.
I will say this, by the way. I think that was not the intent when Jim Buss hired him. I think that they thought this was a better hire. I think they're now... are they low-key tanking for that? You know, look, it's like you said, they only get to keep the pick if it's top three. You need a lot of, you know, ping-pong balls to bounce your way for that to happen, regardless of the record. And that said, are they low-key tanking to keep that pick now?
If I were a Laker fan, I sure hope so. I hope that this amount of terrible wasn't by design. or was by design. If you know you accidentally stumble onto this, that's a problem. And if you're low-key tanking, probably your best move is to keep giving Kobe big minutes.
Yeah. You know what I would like to see? I mean, just as a somebody who wants to see the Lakers develop these guys, play D'Angelo more, play Kobe more, though, with the second unit. Look, if he's out there jacking up shots and they're not going to be shots jacked up by Lou Williams or Nick Young, so be it. Fine. You know, take shots away from Brandon Bass. I don't, you know, who cares? But be an entertaining, ball-hogging second unit.
Are you still going to start him?
That becomes the question. Or you start him and play him limited minutes more with the second unit. Find a rotation with the young guys and let those guys fight through it together. Let them be bad together. You get your low-key tanking out of that and you get some more development, because it's just hard to watch the way they're doing it right now, which is this kind of weird effort to try to win games and to try to not be embarrassing when they're going to be embarrassing. And it's much more, you know, look, I don't think what they're doing in Denver is perfect, but the way they're developing Emmanuel Mudiay makes far more sense to me, you know, what Mike Malone's doing there than what we're seeing, you know, with the Lakers.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's your best move. I think they have a few players who look promising. You have Clarkson and Randall and Russell, and they look like they could be a future core. Maybe get them as many minutes as possible together, and without Kobe, because he's going to hijack it. That's just what it's going to be.
Yeah. Agreed. And I still, you know, I will throw this back out because we will end up with these comments on it. I don't think either of us want to diminish what Kobe's career was. You know, this was an elite NBA career, one of the best shooting guards ever, one of the greatest Lakers ever. He will have his a Locke Hall of Famer, a statue out in front of Staples Center, his number retired up there next to Shaq, and they can fight for position over who gets a higher, you know, spot on the wall or something. But I don't, you know, all of that said, I don't want to diminish all that. And plus, you know, Dan, you and I know at PBT, we're going to run like 8 million, hey, Kobe's 10 greatest moments. You know, videos as we get later into the season. But it is a little strange that, you know, we're talking about the legacy, and there's a lot of talk about the legacy and him trying to change that narrative. They've got 60 plus, you know, 60 something games left of a season. And like you said, it is now going to be the farewell tour. And that starts in Philadelphia on Tuesday, you know, his quote unquote hometown.
Maybe this could actually be a good thing for those young players in that all the attention now is going to be on Kobe and his career and his legacy. And maybe that gives them a little bit more of a chance just to work on basketball, to make it simple, to play together, the three of them, to not have the attention. Because until this announcement, the narrative was pretty much a split. What does a terrible Kobe at this late stage of his career mean for the young Lakers? Yeah. And now that's probably pushed down to the number two narrative, and it's important. But the number one narrative is probably goodbye Kobe.
Yeah, I agree. I agree that they get that out of that. And I think the next step, obviously, you know, we've discussed, I don't know what style of play. I'm not going to sit here and pretend the Lakers should play, you know, obviously I think they should play smaller rather than bigger, but I, you know, the way the NBA is trending, that said, whatever style they're going to be, whoever they may or may not get out of this draft, they've got to pick a coach and empower that coach. And if they're going to go get and I think that this has been part of the problem. Mitch Kupchak wants to, and Jim Buss want some power. If they really want to go get an elite coach, those guys are going to want a lot of player development, say, or, you know, player personnel, say, I should, you know, I mean, they're going to want some say over the roster if you're going to go get a really elite coach. And I'm not sure the Lakers are willing to get that right now or give that.
Yeah, I'd go the other way. I think it was a pipe dream that they could get LeBron,
yeah.
But the idea of letting him choose the coach, like, you got to have, what's your selling point? I mean, yeah, you have a great organization, a great history, and, you know, that matters, and it's a great market, and I think that still matters. Not as much as it did, but it does matter to some
but
degree.
But all these guys, you know, funny, it's like, they spent all that time this summer selling LaMarcus Aldridge on Los Angeles. He had a home here. He lives he lives actually near Kobe in Orange County, but he lives in Southern California all summer long. He plays the Clipper pickup, you know, the legendary Clipper pickups, which is the hot place to play in summer ball. He didn't need to be sold on LA. You don't need to sell these guys on the market as much anymore.
Right. You've got to be strategic with it. I don't want to extrapolate, though, and say LaMarcus Aldridge, how he thinks is how every future free agent is.
Sure. Like, and there was no reason for LaMarcus. LaMarcus needs to win now. The Lakers were not that option even this summer.
And you can always tell a free agent, look, we're going to give you the option. If there's a coach or coaches you want us to look at or hire, you know, if you're Kevin Durant, you can name your coach. If you're a lesser player, maybe you can have some input. Or you can leave it up to the player and say, you know, that's too much responsibility. I don't want to get the blame if it goes wrong. You guys pick a coach, and then you can do it. But if you pick a coach first, you lose that at least potential selling point to a free agent.
That's a good point. And then so if Byron Scott is let go at the end of this year, you think that they'll probably wait through the free agent period to make their pick? Because obviously the Lakers are going to they'll be done in April. I think we can safely say that they will not be making the playoffs this year.
Bold prediction right there.
Living life large right there. And speaking of the Kobe farewell tour, it is quite the showdown Tuesday night in Philadelphia. We will all be tuning in for the powerhouse Sixers versus Lakers game. Do you want to break this down for us in great detail, Dan?
I can give you a very simple 10-foot overview. both teams are terrible. The 76ers are 0-18. They're more desperate. They generally play harder than the Lakers. And I don't think the Lakers' problem is that they don't play hard. But the 76ers, in general, play pretty hard for anybody, let alone such a terrible team. This is their chance to finally get a win. They're going to be at home. They're going to be playing another bad, bad team. You know, I think there are going to be two big things going on. One, I think the 76ers know this is their chance to get in the win column. And I think the Lakers are going to be afraid of being embarrassed. I think that's the reason the 76ers lose a lot of games, is that when it comes down to the end, yes, the talent gap shows when the going gets tight. But when it comes down to the end, the other team knows if we lose to Philadelphia, it's going to be a big deal and it's going to make us look bad. We really need to focus now. And yeah. Teams do. I don't know if the Lakers have that gear, but if they do, we might see it tomorrow night.
They've shown a little of it. I mean, I think against the Pacers, you know, they made it interesting at the end, but they started, A, they hit, again, they hit shots they weren't hitting all night. They hit bad shots. B, the Pacers took their foot off the gas. The Pacers were just not, they toyed with them a little bit. They let them hang around type of game. I think you hit the big issue for me, which is the Sixers do play harder every night. They play hard. I mean, that's a team that whatever you want to say about the talent and Sam Hinkie's grand plan and all that, Brett Brown gets those guys to ball night in and night out.
Yeah, he's done a fantastic job with that element of it. Their concerns are obviously a lot bigger, a lot wider. But in a small sense, people talk about their culture and what effect will this losing have on their culture. And I think those are good, important questions. But Brett Brown's doing his absolute best to mitigate it.
Agreed. And I think, and this has become the other topic when we're discussing the Sixers' culture of late, and that is, you know, Jahlil Okafor's run of incidents. Fight in a parking lot in Boston last week, having a gun pulled on him earlier, you know, I guess back in October, getting pulled over for driving 108 in early November, a string of kind of off-the-field incidents, and it's brought up this topic from a number of corners, both inside the league and in the media, which is, this team is paying a price for not having a strong veteran presence in that locker room, like Kevin Garnett in Minnesota, like Kobe in Los Angeles, that is keeping these guys on the straight and narrow. They're not learning how to be professionals. Do you see that? Do you buy that?
It might be true, but it's such an easy, easy narrative that nobody ever has to prove. Who knows what the 76ers would have been if they had Kevin Garnett? You know, young players sometimes do dumb things. Yeah. Sometimes veteran players do dumb things.
Dan and I, by the way, have no regrets from our late teens and early 20s. We were perfect, but other people I know do have them.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such an easy thing to push that, you know, if they had one veteran in the locker room, or maybe they need two, or you know, you have one but he doesn't play. He's got to be on the court to truly influence these young guys. No, who knows? You know, I mean, maybe Okafor is just a troublemaker. Maybe he, in a different place, he'd be different. The one thing I would say that I do believe with this is if they were winning, there'd be a little bit more in it for him to stay on the straight and narrow. I don't think that necessarily has anything to do with a veteran leader. They could be a young team that's winning. But when the stakes are higher, when there's something in it for a player to make sure he's not in trouble, they tend to stay out of trouble a little more. But again, you know, not everybody's perfect, especially at that age. That stuff happens, and I don't think a veteran leader automatically changes it.
I tend to agree. I don't think Okafor is a troublemaker. I do think, though, that look, I fear the decisions I would have made if I were rich at 19 and had a bunch of free time, which NBA players, by the way, you know, look, it's a hurry up and wait game. You do end up with a lot of free time on your hands. And maybe some guidance from a veteran would help, but you're spot on. It's not going to eliminate the mistakes. It's just after a couple, would a veteran have been able to pull him over and say, dude, get it together. And maybe we don't have the third, possibly. I mean, it is possible. And I think that there is something to be said for, look, nothing against Luke Richard and Bob Mute, who's a, you know, Cameroonian prince and certainly has presence. But, you know, him being around and the guys in the, you know, Carl Landry's in the locker room this year. If it's not a KG type of voice, it's easy to use KG as an example because that's a booming, loud voice. There aren't many of those. And David West wasn't going to go to the Sixers.
Well, I can't. I can't speak to Minnesota specifically, but in general, I've seen, you know, some of these locker rooms where it's a young team with maybe a couple veterans, a lot of times the veterans tend to stick to themselves. So they might not be out at night with Jahlil Okafor teaching him the ways of how to act and how to respond to hecklers. You know, so even with a veteran around, I don't know any of this is different.
I agree. And I will say, by the way, I've gone back to this more than once over time, and there were some veterans early on. When I was around in the locker room of Oklahoma City as they were just starting to become a contending level team years ago, it was the most professional young locker room, or frankly, one of the most professional locker rooms, period, I'd ever been around. And that stood with me. And I think that, you know, yeah, look, they've got some veterans and they've got guys they talk about who taught them. But I think that just goes back to the personalities of Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook, who were not going to let these things get away. Look, no doubt Russell Westbrook loves his fun, loves his fashion, loves wearing shirts that confuse most of us. But, you know, he's serious about his game.
Absolutely, and I might even go a step further, and I do think those two guys get number one and number two credit, but you can throw Sam Presti in the mix. It wasn't an accident that they ended up with young players who, on their own, were self-starters and respectful and professional and all those things. You know, look, you're picking Kevin Durant in that spot no matter what. Yeah. Russell Westbrook seemed like a little bit of a reach at the time, but I think Sam Presti put a little more emphasis on what type of person these guys are than Sam Hinkie has, at least from afar. That's how it appears.
Yeah, and I would agree, and that's coming out of, remember, Presti is coming out of the San Antonio system where that is, you know, that is a big priority for them. And yeah, it does matter. I think that getting the right kind of guys to fit your locker room is a, it's a big deal. And it chemistry does matter. Talent matters more, but at the end of the day, if the chemistry is bad, well, hello, Houston Rockets.
The flip side of that, I agree. It matters so much. It's everything. But it's also very tough to judge. Going into the draft, everybody said Okafor would be this no-nonsense guy. I mean, he seemed to fit that. Maybe the teams in their research knew more than the rest of us did. Maybe that had something to do with him going three when a lot of people thought he'd go two. I don't know.
Duke.
But he hasn't.
Only good people go to Duke, Dan.
So, you know, it's just so hard to judge. So I wouldn't get hung up on making sure 100% you draft a guy like that, because a guy who seems like he might be a troublemaker might not be, and vice versa. But you need to end up with the guy who's not. Easier said than done, but that's what you have to get to.
Well, you know, the other big story going on right now is obviously Golden State's on this huge run. So, Dan, what happens first? And this has been an odd topic around the league, but Sixers win a game? Or Warriors lose a game?
Ooh, I'm going to take the 76ers winning, just because they play hard.
Yeah.
You know, they've got a winnable game coming up right now. You know, I just, as the schedule gets a little more compact, maybe they'll catch a team on a back-to-back or on a road trip a little tired. It's going to be close, but I'm taking Philly. Who do you got?
Yeah, I was going to take Philly, too, just because, look, they have the point differential of a team that should have won a couple of games already. They easily could have beat Houston the other day. They've had, you know, Miami had to have a crazy comeback against them. They could have had a couple wins by now pretty easily. The other question that's out there that I found interesting, which do you think is more likely? And by the way, I think neither of these will happen, but which is more likely? The Warriors win 72 and challenge the Bulls, or the Sixers only win 9 games and challenge for the worst record in NBA history?
Man, that one is so much tougher. I think it's more likely the Warriors get to 72, but I'm with you. I don't think either will happen, but it's just so hard to win only 9 games. It seems incredible that's happened already. 72 made sense. You get a great team, and the West isn't as strong, and you know that's not going to make much of a difference. One or two. I mean, both are so hard. I guess I'd go with 72 is more likely, but I don't think either will happen. Which one are you taking?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the Warriors at 72 is the more likely outcome, but I don't think they get there for a few reasons. A, they're going to start resting guys. They're keeping track of the metrics. Their guys are playing great now, and I think as long as they've got this kind of, they've got this thing to chase, you know, not necessarily 72 yet, but chasing this streak at the start of the season, there's a little bounce in their step that, and a little, you know, maybe they're giving a few more minutes to guys where they might rest them later, although it's been easy to rest Curry lately, and other guys in the fourth just because they've crushed a few teams. But I think that once the air goes out of that streak a little bit, they lose a couple. This falls a little. It might happen. They're on a 7-game road trip that starts this week. That might start then. They have a couple of stumbles, and they, you know, they're going to rest guys at the end. They're looking at the big picture of playing in June and challenging for another title, and 72 isn't going to matter them. I still think they're going to win 65-68. I mean, they're going to be very good, but I think that they're going to take their eyes off the 72.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's a really good point, that when the streak ends, then, you know, all their swagger, all their, you know, the way they're viewing it right now, it'll go back just a little bit. But as far as resting players, I don't know if that really holds them back. Right now, when Stephen Curry is off the court, they outscore opponents by 5.8 points per 100 possessions.
That's ridiculous.
You know, that would rank seventh in the league. They'd be one of the top teams in the moments that Stephen Curry rests. That's crazy. You know, they're deep, they're talented, they're confident. You know, those things aren't going away. But I do agree that when the streak ends, that'll be just a little blip. And if they don't immediately start another big streak, you know, they could fall back into where they're, you know, just an all-time great team, but not the all-time greatest.
Yeah, and I think that they're playing for legacy right now, and they realize that, the 72 wins, this streak is something that will get ultimately mentioned with their legacy, but not like getting two rings, three rings over the next 4 or 5 years type of thing does for their legacy. By the way, the other thing when you're talking about this streak, back out here in L.A., when, you know, the Pau Gasol, Kobe Bryant Lakers were playing well, and somebody would ask Phil Jackson about that, he always said that a West Coast team would never do it because the travel's too hard on a West Coast team eventually. That even getting, you know, to the West Coast games where everybody's really spread out, you know, is hard, you're not as compact, and that the time... all the travel eventually wears on you over the course of the season. Again, this is monitored and sleep is monitored, and they do better with it, I think, than they did back in the day. But I think that there is something to that eventually there is some exhaustion. There is some just tired of being on a plane stuff going on.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's harder for a Western Conference team, but like you said, it's the way the Warriors are traveling is probably less burdensome today than it was for Phil Jackson's Bulls.
Or Phil Jackson's Knicks, who, like, flew coach. Jerry West actually had a really interesting comment. It raised a lot of eyebrows on Twitter and in my timeline because I agreed with him. But he said that right now Draymond Green is a top 10 player in the NBA. You agree?
Oh, you agreed with him?
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to give you seven names. You stop me if you hear one who Draymond is better than, okay? Stephen Curry, Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, LeBron James, Anthony Davis, Blake Griffin, Kawhi Leonard.
No.
Okay, no argument.
No, I'm not, yeah.
I'm going to give you four more. James Harden, ooh, Paul George, Chris Paul, John Wall.
Wall, yes, right now. And I would say Harden the way he's playing right now. I mean, I will say this, by the way, I put it in the post. I agreed with him, but I did this caveat. It only works if you're playing a lot of small ball. Draymond Green playing on Memphis at the three, or Memphis at the four, frankly, all the time doesn't work. Unless you can pair him with Steph and make him a center a lot of the games, or pair him with Chris Paul, or pair him with somebody and make him a dangerous five where you can go small and still defend, it doesn't work. But if you have the person, if you have the point guard to make that work, if you have the personnel to do that, then he is a perfect fit and he does become important.
Yeah, but if you're talking about a top 10 player, and I think he's, you know, somewhere in that next tier, but if you're talking about a top 10 player, if he's really that good and you put him on Memphis, let's say, Zach Randolph's coming off the bench. And, you know, I think he could work with Gasol.
That isn't the worst idea, by the way.
You know, who can play like that Bogut role, and, you know, you can give plenty of minutes to Draymond as a small ball center. So, you know, if he's that good, I'm not worried about the fit. But I think he's the next tier. And, you know, there's guys in that next group, Jimmy Butler, Andre Drummond, Marc Gasol, Damian Lillard, Cousins, Aldridge, Horford. I mean, you go through that whole list, that I would have a hard time saying he's better than 10 of those guys. I'd have a hard time saying he's better than a dozen. I'm a huge Draymond Green fan. I think he's fantastic. But top 10 seems like a stretch to me.
I don't know. I can live with it right now. I think though. I think it's up for debate. Like you said, if he is, he's in the 9 or 10 range. And if you want to make the case that he's 12, 13, 15, even, it's hard to argue because there's so much talent up at the top of that list. But you know, I think it. Look, context matters, and in the context of the Warriors, he's their second best guy. They don't do this without him.
Oh, absolutely. I think he's very underrated. A lot of people still think Klay Thompson is their second best player. He's not. It's Draymond.
No, and I don't, not to knock Klay, but yeah, it is Draymond. They cannot do these things without Draymond. I think you and I both wanted Draymond as Defensive Player of the Year last year. Nothing against Kawhi, who's obviously a fantastic defender, and that was not a terrible choice, but I think people underappreciate how important Draymond is. That ability to play the five and them not to fall off defensively when they go small is everything to them.
I mean, the skill set he brings as a five when they go to a small ball unit, maybe Anthony Davis, and this is it. Who can match this?
Yeah, Blake Griffin is maybe the only other guy. Blake Griffin, maybe, offensively.
No, Blake can't defend the interior the same way. There's three things that I see Draymond doing that nobody else can do all three. Defend the interior, get the ball moving up, you know, up the court the other way, whether it's dribbling it up yourself or passing it ahead, and shooting from the outside. There are a lot of guys who can do two. Not a lot. There are some guys who can do two. You know, Kevin Love can do two. But very few. I think he might be the only one who could do all three at elite levels.
And like you said, his ability to pass, his ability off. I mean, the other part of it is that his offense is just off that pick and roll that nobody can solve with Steph Curry. You know, look, part of that is that Steph Curry is not stoppable. But part of it is that, look, he can pop out and hit a three and you have to defend him. He can roll and finish inside. He can go to the, you know, he can do a half roll and cause you all sorts of trouble with his passing. His ability to put the ball on the floor or make a smart decision is so important to them. But that's, look, when you talk about how teams, you know, drafting guys and fitting guys in the system we were talking about earlier, they drafted nothing but high IQ guys. They went out and got nothing but high IQ guys, to, you know, high hoops IQ guys in Golden State. There were way more of those guys. And there's other teams with good guys, but not the depth of them.
And I'll, you know, before they get offended by anything, I'll add that they're tough as heck too.
Yes. They're not just smart nerds. They've really built such a balanced team. I wanted to ask you, because you're based out of Detroit, you've been going to a lot of Pistons games, about a team that seems to have a little less balance, the Detroit Pistons. What are your impressions of them so far this season? I mean, their record surprised some people. They've had a couple stumbles lately. What's your overall impression of them?
I think they're a much improved team. I think Stan Van Gundy's done an excellent job of getting in a roster that fits the style he wants to play and enabling them to play that way. The problem is, they're not quite good enough shooters around Andre Drummond, you know, to be a very, very good team. They've got several streaky shooters: Reggie Jackson, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Anthony Tolliver, Marcus Morris, Stanley Johnson. You know, guys who can make shots from the outside, but nobody you can depend on. Ersan Ilyasova is probably their best outside shooter, and he's been streaky in the past. He's looked good so far this season, but when those guys are missing from the outside, they look dreadful. When they're making shots from the outside, they look great. You balance it out, it's probably a slightly above average team. They defend well, they play hard. They're a likable team because they play so hard. Their defense has come a long way from last season. So, you know, it's a team on the rise, but in the long run, they're going to have to get in more talent around Andre Drummond.
How good is Stanley Johnson?
You know, he's getting there. He started off, he plays a mile a minute. And it's hard for him. He's not recognizing things, but that's, you know, to be expected for a rookie. You can appreciate a guy who's making mistakes because he's playing too hard. And I think he'll be fine in the long run. He's definitely not there yet. His shot's not there yet. His decision-making's not there yet. But anybody who plays hard, you know, he's going to keep his rotation role, and he's going to get a chance to develop.
Yeah, that's a guy I was, you know, after seeing a little bit at Summer League and then watching him early in the season, have been a lot higher on as a rookie. I think he can develop into something that's really going to work well for them, and you know, his game will develop over time and can be a key piece for them going forward. As is, I guess, Reggie Jackson's going to have to be, because they just paid him a ton of money.
He's been mostly good.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I mean, it hasn't been a great year for guards in the East. I don't think he should be an all-star, but if he plays a little bit better between now and when the coaches vote, he should at least be in the discussion in a weak East for guards this year.
Yeah. Can the West send them a couple? Because the West is just deep, loaded and ridiculous with guards. And then in the East, yeah, you know, especially with Kyrie out, and you know, he might be back. We probably will be back before the All-Star game, but are you going to put him in after he's played for 6 weeks? I mean, I don't.
Well, I've got a different view of how you should pick All-Stars than most people. So I would, yeah.
Yeah, well,
the way I do it is I look at who's the best player right now. I'm not looking at who's accomplished the most over half a season. Yeah. We know what Kyrie is. We know he's a very good player. We know he's one of the best guards in the East. If he's back and healthy and playing like that, I'd put him in even if he's only played one game.
Plus, it's an exhibition, man. And you know what the fans want to see? Kyrie Irving. You know, it's...
And they might just vote him in.
It wouldn't be shocked. It wouldn't be shocked.
You know what? Going back, I know one thing Kobe did with his retirement announcement. He clinched winning the fan vote to start as... You know, I think that was in question before because there was so much negative attention. And by announcing the retirement now, he's a lock.
Yeah, he's a lock. And honestly, even if the fans didn't vote him in, they're going to... You know, the commissioner occasionally adds that 13th person to the roster. Kobe will be there. He'll be on the West roster. He will play a few minutes. He will get the adulation. What I'm worried about, honestly, is that they're going to give him a spot in Rio. And that's a whole nother discussion that we didn't get into. But I don't think he's earned an honorary spot on the Olympic team. Like, he's got multiple goals. He'd be up for it if they offered it. But I think you've got to make the younger players happy.
I agree. You know, it's such a coveted spot. Give it to somebody who's earned it. He earned it in his time.
Yeah.
And now let somebody else. Would he have a problem, or would Team USA have a problem? You know, if you want him as an ambassador or something like that, just bring him in that role. He doesn't need to have a roster spot.
Especially in a, you know, the way FIFA does it, you get a hard and fast 12. You get 12 guys, and once the Olympics start, if somebody goes down injured, you got 11 guys. Like, you don't, yeah, it's a much different system, so you can't, I don't think you can... Not that, you know, look, the U.S. is so far out in front that could they bring in Kobe and win the gold? Yeah, certainly. But I'm opposed to it in concept. I think you've got to earn that. To be on that stage should be earned. And it's not that Kobe hadn't earned it in the past. Frankly, we don't probably have the 2008 gold without him. They might very well have lost to Spain that year. That said, I can't justifiably put him on that roster. So I can't justifiably put Tim Duncan on that roster either. Or I guess he wouldn't play for the U.S. anyway, would he?
No, sir.
But you should put Kawhi Leonard on. The Spurs, man, nobody is talking about the 14-3 Spurs. They're really good.
But they're not undefeated.
Well,
that's all we want to talk about, undefeated teams and winless teams and Kobe. Yeah.
Yes, and Greg Popovich is okay with that. He is just fine being, you know, on... Look, they're on pace for, I guess that works out to about mid-60s wins. They'll back that off a little bit as they... We know he will rest guys. And they will sacrifice some wins down the road. But clearing away the second-best team in basketball?
Yeah. Cleveland maybe.
Cleveland maybe. Healthy.
Right. But so far, from what they've shown so far, absolutely, it's San Antonio.
Yeah. And I think I want to end up, since we're in the Midwest earlier with Detroit and now talking San Antonio and Texas, with one more Midwestern team that I saw last night. I really like what I'm seeing out of Indiana. That Frank Vogel has done a great job. This team came together on the small ball and what they're doing a lot faster than I think, you know, he implied to me he didn't think it would be this fast. He knew that they'd catch it eventually. I don't think he thought it would be this early, or that they'd be this good this early. But... And then he started going into coach speak about how, well, we've got a long way to go and our defense needs work and yada, yada, yada. But this team looks really good.
Yeah. One thing that really stands out to me with them, and I got a chance to see them in person already this year too, they swarm to the ball defensively. Yes. They pressure. They force a lot of turnovers, and that gets them running. I think they rushed into small ball in a way that left them without the right talent to do it. But Vogel's done a tremendous job. And when you can run like that defensive, you know, coming off a defense and run and get those easy baskets, that makes a lot of difference. And it makes a lot of difference that Paul George looks like an MVP candidate again.
Yeah, he does. I'll tell you, the other thing he was doing defensively, big men would grab, you know, now granted, these are the Laker big men, but they were grabbing rebounds, spinning around, trying to look around for where the outlet pass is or what they wanted to do. And he'd circle behind them, and he had one steal. He just circled behind the guy, knocked it away, picked it up, chased it into the corner, knocked down a three before anybody realized what had happened. He tried about three more times. He's making little smart gambles on certain players. He's clearly read the scouting report. Like, this guy holds the ball low. We can get away with this. They're just little things like that that they were doing well all game long. George Hill is playing fantastically. Monta Ellis is playing within himself most of the time. It's really kind of, you know, Mahimi's looked good. I was really impressed with how they played top to bottom. And I, by the way, I watched him play the Lakers, and that was maybe a C-plus game, if that. I mean, they really, nobody seems to take the Lakers terribly seriously and really bring it, and they still looked good.
Yeah, you know, as this team learns this new way of playing, I think on paper at least, and, you know, there's always surprises, but on paper, this seems like the type of team that improves more throughout the season than the average team.
Yeah. Does that make them, I mean, the second best team in the East come the end of the season? Miami's there, but I don't know how much better Miami gets, although their offense should improve.
And I think their defense is going to regress to the mean a little bit. I think overall Miami is going to change how they play a little bit, but I think their level of play is about right.
Yeah, I think
there are several teams right there.
No, I agree. There is an interesting cluster in that, you know, Toronto's in that mix in the East.
The Bulls, too.
Bulls. Yeah, maybe it's me. I'm not as sold on them yet. And that could just be something simple like their offense is a lot weaker than I thought it would be, and maybe they'll figure it out. Maybe they'll finally start starting Noah and Mirotic and bringing Gasol off the bench, which is what you want this? I think everybody wants this. Isn't this what we're all calling for?
Well, I guess that would be what I would try next. I'm not completely sold that's the move, but yeah, I think that'd be a good thing to try.
Yeah, I think they're still figuring it out, and I'm just a little less sold that they figure it out, maybe. It's because, based on history, it doesn't go that well. But they're certainly in the mix. It's an interesting second tier in the East. I think it makes for an interesting Eastern Conference playoffs come the end of the season, save that. Is anybody really beating Cleveland?
Nope. But it'll be fun to see who gets to play them in the conference.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not the bloodbath that the West would be, but I'm not sure that the West is going to be the bloodbath we thought it would be either. So
maybe at the top, but no, those lower West teams are not.
Yeah, it's the depth we thought was there in the West isn't there. The top three to four, Thunder, Spurs, and Warriors are clearly good. I still have this sense that the Clippers will get it together better and be better.
I think so too.
And be that fourth team. And so their top four is deep, but after that, yeah, it is a drop-off. So, well, Dan, thanks for joining us today. We are going to have you on regularly with the podcast. Like I said, we're back now Mondays and Thursdays the rest of the week. So check us out on iTunes, or you can check us out at Pro Basketball Talk and listen to it through the site, whatever makes you happy. We're all about making you happy, aren't we, Dan?
Absolutely.
We're nothing but customer service oriented here at NBC Sports. All right. Thanks a lot, and we will talk to you soon.